Now, let me give you a quick outline of the things which we're going to do tonight. There are several ones right down in the very front, and the ones right down in the front are to your great advantage because you pick up the asides there. Anything which may be lost, you pick up in the front row. It's a great benefit to sit in the front row. I know that most people don't ever do that, but it is to your advantage. Now, what I propose to do tonight is, for the sake of folk who were not here last week — by the way, you are not being chided when I say that, you were not supposed to be here last week if you were not supposed to be here — but for the benefit of those who are not there, I want to go over and make quickly an outline of what I see to be the salient features of dialogue evangelism itself. I have a feeling that a new power is surging through me, which I was not aware of before. So I'll go over dialogue evangelism again, and we will talk about the gospel outline, which we're going to use. And for those of you who were not there last week, we'll spend some time on that. I want to say a word about apologetics, because that is the major bulk of the work we're going to spend our time at. What am I supposed to say to people when they ask me questions about the Christian life? What answers are there that we can give? And then we will spend a little bit of time talking about certain of the factors which are at work when we meet in groups. I will set you some homework to do for next week. There will be plenty of time for questions, and we will finish as soon as it's possible to do that after 9 o'clock. I'm sure that you'll be glad of that extra half hour up your sleeve, but I'm saying that now. I am aiming to finish at 9 o'clock, so you can be certain that the last of us will be able to get out, if you want to, by 7:30. We will stop for supper at 7:15, and we will resume again promptly at 8:15. During that time, there will be things which you can use usefully, and I hope that next week we will be able to spend some of that time in actually revising some of our homework, because the only way to know if you know what to say is to hear yourself saying it. It's already, you know, those marvellous people who work it out in their mind what they'll say. I'm saying it's no good unless you have actually articulated what it is you intend to say when the time comes to say it. It's all very well thinking you might be able to work it out when the time comes. I'm saying if you cannot articulate it, you cannot articulate it. And when the time comes, let me tell you, when you get into a dialogue meeting, if you're hoping then by some strange movement that you'll be able to do it, let me tell you, you'll have Buckley's. Because you'll be so nervous then, and there'll be so many other things going against you, that if you cannot do it when everything's going for you, you certainly won't have Buckley's of doing it when everything's heading against you. Forgive me for putting it so baldly like that. I am a great believer that the best spontaneity comes through hard work and practice. I know there are others who think that other agencies at work, and every now and again a miracle does seem to take place, about once every 5 million years. It takes place, I've discovered, in this, and you might be lucky enough just to bang on it. But in case you don't, get prepared. Well, let me say a brief word about dialogue evangelism to begin with. Paul describes the gospel in many ways in his writings. Sometimes he describes it as the power of God unto salvation. He does that in Romans 1:15. Sometimes he talks about it as the preaching of the death and resurrection of Jesus for the forgiveness of sins, as you see I've listed there in 1 Corinthians 15. He describes it in terms of a message to be proclaimed in 1 Corinthians 5:19. He says he's got a message to tell. He describes it in terms of words to be spoken in Romans 15. He further describes those words as the words of faith which are to be preached in Romans 10:8. And in 1 Corinthians 5, he says it is the word of truth to be listened to and to be acted upon. Now, if you find that my writing is different from the words I'm uttering, take down the writing, will you? I did those with greater care. Now, it should be 2 Corinthians, is it? 5:19. Indeed, should it? Well, I'll check that one out and let you know. I have a suspicion that it should be 2 Corinthians 5:19, because will he not be saying that the message of reconciliation has been committed to him? It should be 2 Corinthians, you see. Well, there you are. Black Mark Chapman. So I'll just correct that. See, that's the lovely part about that. 2 Corinthians. Oh, dear. It's there. Look, this is... Does anybody have a word of testimony or a hymn they'd like to bring now? All right. Thank you for that helpful word, brother. Now, what I want to say in this is that the gospel, if it is expressed in words, can be discussed. And you will notice in Acts 17:2 that that is precisely what is taking place. That the gospel is being discussed and it is being argued for. In Philippians 1:7 and in Acts 17:7, the same idea is being put forward. Since it is expressed as the words of truth, then the Christian should discuss it truthfully. Now, I say that to you because it might seem perfectly obvious to you, but there seem to me to be a great deal of discussion go on in Christian circles which got anything to do with the truth, anything but. And I'll explain to you what I mean later. Since the message is a powerful word, the Christian can look to God to honour that truthful discussion of the gospel. Now, I'm only saying this to begin with because dialogue evangelism is a method of proclaiming the gospel through discussion and debate. That is, I say what I think the gospel is, people tell me why they don't believe it. I tell them why I think they ought to believe it, they tell me why they think it isn't worth believing. I tell them why they ought to believe it, they tell me why their problems are. I tell them why they ought to believe it, and so it goes on. I believe the gospel, because it can be expressed in words, is able to be discussed because they are the words of truth, the words of faith, words, which is the message from God. We can engage in this activity. And its aim is to clarify the words and the ideas of the gospel so that men will understand it and be in a position to act on it. How they act depends on God's Holy Spirit, if they're going to act positively. And that is the point I make in 2 Corinthians 4. It is God's work to open their eyes so they see the glory of God in the face of Jesus. What is my job? My job is to faithfully proclaim the word of truth, the gospel, and intrinsic to that proclamation is to urge men to be reconciled to God. Now, I say that because right at the very basis of what I'm doing, this is what I see to be the method of dialogue evangelism. Now, what does it in actual fact consist of? We'll give that a rest for a while. Well, those of you who were there last week will realise that there's nothing terribly new about what we do in dialogue evangelism. Christian people invite their non-Christian friends. You'll notice how quickly I say that, but I realise it's not as easy as it is. You can trip it off your lip faster than you can actually do it, can't you? But Christian people invite their non-church-going friends to their home. Somebody comes along who we call a dialogue leader. We don't normally introduce him to people like that. I mean, that would be the most frightening thing of all. We simply say something like, we're having a few friends in on Tuesday night for supper. A friend of ours, John Chapman, is coming, and we're going to talk about Christianity with him. Would you like to join us? I may not have said this to you last week, but you will find it advisable, in my judgment, not to issue an invitation to your guests to supper until you've told them about the discussion and what we're going to do. For they may find themselves in the embarrassing situation of not wishing to refuse your supper invitation while wishing to refuse your invitation to discuss the gospel. So what we've found at home is a valuable thing to do is to say, we're having a few friends in on Tuesday night and we're going to talk about Christianity. Would you like to join us? And when they say yes, we'll say, well, can you make it for supper? You may find that a wiser thing. A friend of mine taught me that he found that his friends were in a dilemma. They wanted to say yes to his gracious invitation. They wanted to say no to the terrible prospect of the gospel. And they found themselves on the horn of the dilemma, not knowing which way to go. For every person who can guarantee us 6 non-Christians, we'll give them a dialogue leader at home. And we think that that is the minimum number of people that you can have in a room. The reason for that is that if you've got a smaller number than that, they feel that they're being got at. There are just not enough of them. Everybody's out in the open if there are only 3 or 4. And as I said last week, you can tell 1,000 people that they're sinful and nobody thinks you mean them in particular. But if you've only got 3 in the room, you've got to be looking at one of them when you actually get to the crunch. And so that's one of the major problems. The other thing, too, is that we want to keep the maximum number of people to about 20. My own view is that the ideal number is about a dozen. The great problem, if the meeting gets any bigger, as you're going to see as we move along through our training sessions, is that when we get into a very big group, people are threatened, and especially if they don't know each other. We're not too sure whether people will understand us, so we're frightened to ask questions. You'll see when it comes to question time that it will be like that. I hope you will quickly try and overcome that, because when it comes time for questions, or when I ask for a response, I want people to speak. I want you to speak quickly, because I don't want to waste time. You are amongst your friends here. They may not look as if they are your friends. They may not sound as if they are your friends. I may not sound as if I am your friend. Believe me, I am on your side, even when I appear not to be. I remember once a lady said to me that she rang me up. She just finished reading the notes to host and hostesses, and she discovered she wasn't to invite any more than 20 people, and she rang me up in great despair, and she said, "I've got 25 people coming, what will I do?" I said, "Send 5 of them home." She said, "What?" I said, "Oh, well, we'll make an exception for you." I said, "How's managed to get 25? She was in the Carlingford Old Girls Tennis Club or something. Good gracious, they were old girls too. They looked at me about 90 in the shade. How they played tennis, I haven't got the faintest idea. Anyway, they all arrived with their husbands, and every one of them had a little piece of paper, which threw me a bit. I didn't quite know what was on the piece of paper. I was simply the only odd man out. Anyway, she told them they all had to come with a question ready. And so the 25 of us sat round in glorious magnificence around this great lounge room, and she said, "Start." So he rose up and read his question out. I answered that. She said, "Next." And we went round. I said, "I think we'd better make up a few weeks for this, because we're certainly not going to get round to 25 questions. It certainly wasn't what I had had in mind, and I'd served me right for not having conveyed it properly to her. When people come, what do we normally do then? In some way or other, they'll be entertained in a way. We just tell people to entertain them in a way which is normal for them. And the dialogue leader needs to be a flexible sort of a person who'll be happily able to fit into whatever he discovers which is going on. And in your part of the world, it may not be too much diversity. In our part of the world, there's a great deal of diversity between the way people entertain their guests from one part of Sydney to the other. I think it's absolutely essential at the very outset that you should tell people what you're going to do when they get there. I'll explain to you one of the reasons that it's very unsettling if you arrive at a group and you're not too sure what's going to happen at it. But it's essential that we should tell them that it's going to be an informal night. It's going to be a night where people are going to talk about the gospel. You are going to have an outsider who's coming. That all of these things are going to take place. I remember Ken Short telling me he went to a dialogue meeting one night. And he arrived, they'd had a magnificent supper together, they settled down at the lounge room over coffee, and the hostess said, "I didn't tell you why I've invited you tonight, because I knew you wouldn't come if I told you, but..." Ken Short said, "I felt like packing up and going home at that moment." And he said many others looked as if they wished they'd packed up and gone home also. Well, let me tell you one of the things that we discover. When we get there, the dialogue leader goes through a brief outline of the gospel. And then it's an open slather for anybody who wants to ask questions or make contributions. It's in that question time that people begin to grapple in two ways with the gospel. First of all, they begin to articulate what they believe about Christianity. Now, I don't know what it's like in your part of the world. I can only tell you what it's like in our part of the world. In our part of the world, that in itself, in my judgment, is a gracious act to people. To give them the opportunity to meet together and start to articulate what they think about the things of God is in itself helpful. Life is so busy in Australia that the average person never stops to think about whether God might really be there or not. And I don't believe in our part of the world that the average adult has put his mind to Christian things for years and years and years. Whether God might be there or not is totally irrelevant. Everybody knows what they ought to be doing. They ought to be making more money. And they're doing it with a great deal of gusto in our part of the world, so they can take off on their world trip this year and maybe next year and the year after and the year after that. And we, of course, are constantly being bombarded by the fact that it's a great consumer society, and if you've already got the two cars or the three cars for your family, you need to put another roof on the top, you need another garage to house them all in, you now need the boat to put on the trailer, and you need lots of other things to play with in the car because it takes you all day Sunday to drag the boat through the traffic to the water. Then you've got to leave early to get home to play with all the other things. Now, everybody knows their goals are set. And it takes up a great deal of your time to do that because often you have to get a job in the daytime and a job at night. And everybody knows that that's what's got to be done. And you certainly don't have time to put your mind as to whether God might be there or not because you'll have lots of time to do that later. And so when the time comes, you can leave that for later, but now is not the time to do it. My own opinion of the average Australian man is that he has never put his mind to thinking about whether God might be there, and if he did, he hasn't done it since he was in his early teens. And as they begin to articulate their reasons for not being Christian, often they realise that it's a totally inadequate reason. A man said to me one night, he'd been talking on and on and on, and then he said, well, that's not really a very good reason, is it? Well, I always agree with them, because it never is. Often they're childish things which are being said, and I think the reason is because most people have made their judgments when they were children. I find when I go to high schools, in the earliest classes at secondary schools, children are violently opposed to the idea that God is there. Now, when did they make up their minds? They certainly did it when they were in primary school. That's by the time you're 9 or 10 in our part of the world. And they never review the situation. And then when they tell you their reasons, they're totally inadequate. Dick's got a wonderful story, he might tell you some night, about a person who told in the New Testament was written in the 12th century in Persian. I met a man who told the most incredible things. People give you reasons why they're not believers. And often their reasons are totally inadequate reasons. And they themselves discover it as they're articulating it. The second thing which I find valuable about it is that they tell me what they think I've been articulating, which is even, of course, more surprising because it isn't what I've been articulating at all. They say what they think they've heard me say about the gospel. And, of course, it is not like that at all. The other things we've discovered is that people who are too shy to come to the church building will often come to your home. But just let me say in passing, if a strange man, came and knocked at your door one evening and said, I represent the local branch of the Young Communists and I'm just inviting people to come to supper to talk about communism, I wonder if you'd like to join us. Do you think that he would get a positive answer from you or a negative one? And I would think, from my point of view, it would be an exceptional night if, first of all, I was in any position to say yes to him or if I had any desire to say yes. And I find it a complete mystery that anybody should accept an invitation who's never had an invitation from you before. And I wonder if the reason why the New Testament is constantly urging us to be people who are given to hospitality is because it expects us to be people given to hospitality. Could you just think that might be the reason? Could that just be the reason? And I cannot work out why anybody should accept an invitation to anybody's place to hear about the gospel if they've never had an invitation to that place before. I remember ages and ages ago, I was talking about dialogue evangelism in the home of one of their parishes out at Sutherland, and Cliff Oates, who's a church warden, said he romped home like mad that night and said to Ruth, listen to this sort of evangelism, Ruth. There's a bloke who's been at our church tonight who's talking about asking us to invite our non-Christian friends into the home and he'll come and speak in small groups. She said, that's terrific, Cliff. Who will you ask? And he said, I didn't even know the name of the people who lived in my block. I didn't even know their names. She said, who will you ask, Cliff? He said, I don't know, who will I ask? She said, well, you don't know anybody. So he said, I set two to rectify it. I said, what'd you do, Cliff? He said, that very night, I went round and knocked on the whole door of everybody in our block. And I said, I'm Cliff Oates, I live in 57. Ruth and I had been living there for 5 years, and we discovered tonight that I do not even know my neighbours. We're asking the whole block in on Saturday afternoon for a barbecue because we'd like to get to know our neighbours. Would you like to come? He said we discovered we had some very nice neighbours. We also discovered we had some rats. But he said we at least discovered them. He said the strange part about it was, in a month's time, our next door neighbours had the whole lot into their place and invited us back again. He said the following Sunday week they had a bus picnic for their block. And he said I discovered a whole new community came to life. And he said I soon discovered that I had to stop doing other things to give myself to them because it was very costly in time. When we had a dialogue meeting in his home 9 months later, he had every second one of his neighbours who were there. Now, I simply say that to you because it's very difficult. The longer you're Christian, the less likely you are to have many non-Christian friends. Now, there are reasons for that. Sometimes they drop you like a hot cake. If it is the other reasons, well, then we will have to take strong steps to rectify it. If it means that you and I are steadily opting out of the difficult situations where we keep encountering non-Christians, then I believe we've got to steel ourselves to do it. It was very interesting. I went to Weight Watchers 18 months ago, and it was interesting to me. You can arrive at Weight Watchers at 7:30, pay your money, leap on the scales and sit down for the lecture. On the other hand, you can arrive when the first lot come at 6:30, and it gives you a good hour. Now, what can you do in a hall with people sitting around for an hour? The only thing you can do is talk. And, of course, what do you talk about? You talk about the thing that's on your mind. And the thing that's on your mind at Weight Watchers is what is on your hips or some other part of your body. And so the first thing, people are talking there. They feel as if you belong. I found it a very fruitful field for evangelism. I always got there early. Got there the first one I could get there. Found out what time the place opened, 6:30, every week 6:30. Yak, 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 because I know when you're talking, you may get round to say something about the gospel. I tell you the other thing, that anyone who's put on weight at Weight Watchers has had a terrible week. And there's only one reason why compulsive eaters have been eating, because things have been going wrong, and if things have been going wrong, are they not likely to talk about it? And the answer to that is, yes, they are. Now I stumbled on it. I didn't realise it could be such a good and fruitful field. But to get there early, are you in anything? Do you join anything where you keep meeting unbelievers? And if the answer to that is no, we've got to radically change our lifestyle. That's all there is about it. If you are too busy to give yourself to non-Christians, you are too busy. That's all there is about it. Now, I'm so glad I don't know any of you very well, because you may actually feel the rector's put me up to it. But isn't that honestly the case? I realise that it takes time to do that. The bloke who lives in the block of flats underneath me, I've been praying for a long time. He's a lapsed Roman, his wife is a Mormon. I lend them records, they lend me records. We're golfing one day, and I said to him, we're just going around the course. I don't normally talk to people about the gospel while golfing. I find that you've got to have every faculty on the ball. There are so many things that can go wrong. All you need to do is mention sin and anything could happen. Well, we're going around and he said to me, you know what happened to me on the weekend? I said, I'd believe anything. What happened to you on the weekend, Gary? He said, I went over to Roselands. It's a shopping plaza. And he said, I just had enough money for a flagon of port. And he said, I bought a Bible instead. Well, I said, that won't do you any harm. Seemed to me a very strange combination. I'd consider that a near miracle. Anywhere, but amongst an Australian, it's a complete miracle. I said, did you? I said, how do you find it? He said, it's very interesting, isn't it? He said, I went to church with my wife on Sunday night. He says, the worst sermon I've ever heard. I said, I am sorry. I wonder if you and Bronwyn would like to be my guests on Sunday night. There are marvellous sermons where I go. I said, would you like to talk that over with Bronwyn? He said, sure I will. Now, you know the terrible feeling when it's all over. You never know whether you've done enough or whether you haven't done enough. That's what comes from not trusting God. You say, did I push him far enough? Didn't I push him far enough? Should I have made a date then? Shouldn't I? You see, everything but trust God. You see, got the point? Won't labour it. So I went to my prayers. Nothing happens that week, nothing happens the next week. After about a month had gone by, I'd just about written it off, but I'd certainly been praying for him, and I'd asked all my godchildren to pray for him. I'm not too sure what a godfather is supposed to do. I'm the godfather to many children. I went to see the movie, but it was no help to me at all. And I don't know what you're supposed to do with your godchildren, but I've decided that I ought to at least be praying for them, and so I've written to them to tell them I'm praying for them, and I ask them to pray for me. I tell them about current things that are happening, and I ask them if they'll tell me about current things that are happening so that I can pray specifically for them. And I urge them to do the same for me. And so all my godchildren are actually going flat out on Gary and Bronwyn. They live underneath. Don't want to complicate the issue. One thing at a time is enough for them to pray for. And so they can go on that pair. I hear him banging away at his garage. And I know that anybody who's banging away in a garage can always do with another pair of hands. Now, I only say this to you not because I think I'm terribly good at it, but there were plenty of things I had on my mind that Saturday morning. I honestly could have spent a dozen Saturdays, and I had that one. And isn't it always the way when you hear somebody bang away in their garage, it's on the Saturday when you've got a great long list of things to do. I went down, I said, "What are you making, pal?" He said, "I'm making a bench." I said, "Do you want a pair of hands?" He said, "I sure do." So we worked away the morning down there, and as we're going along, he said to me, "What day are you going to take me to church?" I said, "I'm going to take you tomorrow night." "That's the night." He said, "Great." I said, "Well, then you and Bron will be my guests for dinner, will you? And we'll go straight after dinner." Now, I say that to you because on two occasions they've invited me back to dinner. On the last occasion I had time to invite them back to my place to dinner, we talked about Christian things from the time they walked in the door at 8 o'clock until they left in the early hours of the morning. We had played records endlessly during that time. He had brought a pile of his, I had a pile out of mine. It was a fight to see who'd get the next one on next. But we talked constantly about the things of God. Neither of them are Christian, in my judgment, yet. But I'll tell you the great tragedy of that story, is that on six separate occasions since that last time I had them to dinner at my place, they have invited me back to dinner, and I haven't been able to find a free night to go back. And that is monstrous, in my opinion. Something is radically wrong with my life. If there are good opportunities to preach the gospel like that, and I cannot find time, what I ought to do is be writing out nights in my diary so that there are times so that I can give myself to people. It is very costly in terms of money, and it is very costly in terms of time to give yourself in hospitality. I know both of those to be true. And I can also tell you that it pays dividends to give yourself to people. And we must make sure that we have time to make ourselves available. Now, one of the things we discovered in our part of the world was that it was easy enough to ask people to invite their non-church-going friends, but they didn't really have any. And if you find yourself in that capacity, and if you find you've got friends in that capacity, let me say that we're talking about a 5-year project from now on. I think that's about how long it takes you to make firm friends. So start. But if you don't start, you won't have them next year when it comes on again. And if you don't start next year, you won't have them the year after. And let me say that we cannot engage in what I consider to be the most effective part of evangelism, which is the person-to-person, if you don't actually have contact with non-Christian people. Well, so much for that one. That was the first thing we discovered. The second thing we discovered in most of the Anglican parishes in our part of the world is that all initiative in evangelism lay in the hands of the clergy. That if the clergy actually urged their people to do it, they did it. When we stopped urging them, they stopped doing it. Many people opened their home once. They got quite a surprise. Non-Christian people actually came. They could hardly believe it. My great vision was that they would keep on using their home, having done the hardest thing. But the moment we took the moment we didn't do it anymore in that way, they didn't do it again either. When the clergy asked them if they'd like to follow it up, they all got busy and followed it up. When the clergy did not ask them, they didn't do it again. I think that's a very serious situation that we are in. My hope is, of course, that it will be totally different in this part of the world. That you will see that it is your responsibility to keep looking for ways to keep doing evangelism. I mean, when I picked up that bloke going along through King's Cross on the night, it never occurred to me that I ought to stop at the phone box and ring up the rector whose parish I was travelling through to see if it would be all right to talk to him about Christ. I had to travel through four or five parishes that night. It never occurred to me. I just considered it's my responsibility to speak to him. It was a good night. He was magging away. I was magging away. If you can imagine, I'd picked him up if he was magging away. I was magging away, really. He was trying to get in, muscle in when I stopped for a breath. But I don't ring up the Archbishop, see if it's all right for me to speak to people. And I can't work out why any other Christian should be different for that. I believe we've got to start praying that God will keep opening ways for us to speak to people about Christ. Now, most people are frightened to keep praying that in case they get an answer in the positive. During the course of the time, I want to try and persuade you that you can trust God. He is a thoroughly trustworthy person. Can you, if you ask God for opportunities, can you, if you ask God to lead you to the people to ask to your home, could you really trust God to lead you to the right people? Could you do that? Or is he the sort of God who will bring your worst fears to pass? He'll actually bring you to somebody and lead you up the garden path. You'll get into a situation which goes totally out of hand and you won't be able to cope with it. He's not that sort of a God. He won't leave you up the garden path like that. If you and I give ourselves to prayer, ask God to make us bold. I met a man in Philadelphia in 1974. He said that he had been quite disillusioned with himself and the church he was in because he said he sensed that they should have been going out with the gospel. He sensed that, but they weren't doing it. And he kept reading in the Bible in three or four places. You'll remember in Acts 2 and Acts 4 where Peter and John get that strong word of condemnation by the Sanhedrin, how they are not to go on preaching the gospel anymore. And they come home and they have the prayer meeting. And somebody had the presence of mind to write the prayers down afterwards. And the prayers they prayed was that God would give them boldness to preach the gospel. And then we read at the end of that chapter that they were filled with the Spirit and their prayer was answered. They spoke the word with boldness. Paul in Ephesians 6, in prison, asks that he will be able to speak the word boldly as he ought to speak. I'm going to let you in on a secret. You never pray for something if you think you've already got it. You don't ask God to make you bold to preach the gospel if you're bold already doing it. Don't you think that's an incredible thing that the Apostle Paul found it difficult to preach the gospel? I'm terrifically encouraged by that. That he actually asked people to pray that he'd be bold. Now, I wouldn't mind if you did that for me. During the 3 months I'm here in London, will you pray for me that I'll be bold in preaching the gospel, that I will not be frightened to confront people with the gospel? And will you be brave enough to pray it for yourself? Pray that God will lead you to somebody tomorrow that you can deal with. And the wonderful part about it is, when God leads you to people, I find he's not a bit subtle. He may be subtle with you. You might be the sensitive, subtle type who can pick it up. I'm about as subtle as a train smash at 90 miles an hour. It's no good you being subtle with me. It'll be lost. Please don't be subtle with me. Be blatant. I find that's the wonderful part about God. Every time he guides me in something, it's blatant. It's as plain as a pikestaff. You've got to be thoroughly disobedient to get out of it. I pick up this bloke going through King's Cross. I know you can't talk about the gospel unless you're talking. So I start talking. You won't ever get round to say the gospel if you're sitting there like a dummy in the car. So I picked him up. I ought to speak to him. I said, what sort of a night have you had, pal? Oh, he said, so-so. Well, I said, that's life, isn't it? You win a few, you lose a few. That hasn't got us anywhere. That's finished. So you've got to take another tack. I say, what do you do for a crust? He said, I'm a stuntman in movies. I said, you're joking. No, he said, I am. I said, you're the only one I've ever met. Don't waste time. Talk. Tell me all about it. I might never meet another one. Go on, talk for the lick of your life. Go. Flat out. Well, he began to tell me about it, and then I made the fatal error of saying, what is the life expectancy of a stuntman? What I really meant was, how long could you be physically fit to do it? Well, I think he was slightly shaken by that question, and he sort of said, well, he didn't. Anyway, we yacked on for a while, and then suddenly out of the blue he said to me, what do you do for a living? I am now praying that God will open the door wide, because whatever answer I give now, I don't want the door to bang shut. And I am in prayer. I've been praying for the bloke before I picked him up. I've been praying the whole time we've been talking that the conversation will get to the gospel. It may not. God is the sovereign God. You can trust him to take it to the gospel or away from it, whichever way it pleases him on that person at that moment. But it's a God-given moment now. He says, what do you do for a living? I know if you say you're a clergyman, that causes the door to bang closed faster than anything else. I said, the Church of England pays me to try and persuade people to become Christians. Well, he laughed like mad. He said, strike, they must be hard up. I said, brother, they are. I said, they've been doing it for a long time. He said, on the level. I said, yeah, on the level. I am still praying that the door will come open because he hasn't heard the word of life. He's heard nothing. You see, all he knows is that the Church of England pays me to try and persuade people to become Christians. He said to me, how do you do it? I said, once again, I'm at prayer. Whatever I say, I want the door to widen open. I want to have a good opportunity to talk to him about the gospel. My foot's taken off the accelerator. We're moving a bit slower now. I want the journey to take a long time. I said, I meet with people in their homes and I just talk about the gospel. He still doesn't know enough. Now, there's every chief might say, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Do you think it's going to rain? And that's guidance. That's come to an end. But I'm praying that it will not come to an end. To my great delight, he says to me, what do you say to them? Now I tell you, that's good and subtle, isn't it? If that is not a God-given moment, I've never seen it. So I say, well look, I've got an outline with 5 points. And I just say to them that this is God's world, that he is there. I went through my 5 points. He said, well that seems reasonable. I said, of course it's reasonable. And I said, where are you heading, pal? He said, I'm going to Cronulla. He said, where are you going? I said, I don't go anywhere near Cronulla, but that's where I'm driving you because I want to talk to you about God. And we had a very fruitful time, and he still is an unbeliever so far as I know. I go to drop my dry cleaning in at Town Hall Station. Can you really trust God? That's the line I'm thumping. You got the line I'm thumping? Can you really trust God if you say, oh God, will you guide me to people? The very people you want me to speak to, can you trust the sovereign God to do it? I go down to drop my dry cleaning at the Town Hall Station. She knows I'm a clergyman down there. She's seen me with a doggo every once in a while. I drop my dry cleaning in. She said, are you a priest? I said, too right. She said, well, what I want to know is, can you forgive my sins? I said, no, not a hope. She said, that's what I reckon. She said, if I just say a good prayer, I'll get forgiven, won't I? I said, lady, you can say a good prayer or you can say a lousy prayer. It'll do you no good. You'll still be unforgiven. She said, what? I said, I don't care if you say a good one or if you say a bad one. You'll still be unforgiven. Her mate at the dry cleaners said, are you sure you're a clergyman? I said, lady, I am one. I give you my word. She said, why don't you wear one of those things around your neck? I say, to trick people like you, watch it. They're all around us. She said to me, the other one said, what is it I've got to do then? Now, you see, if you miss that as a God, you've got to be thoroughly disobedient, don't you, to get out of that situation. Nothing subtle about that. The moment's arrived. You've got to come out right in the open and say what you know to be true. Doesn't always happen like that to me, but it happens like that. And I tell you what I discover. The more I pray for opportunities, the more I get. And the less I pray for them, the less I get. And I'll tell you for why. Because when I pray for opportunities, I start looking for them. And when I start looking for them, I start finding them. And when I don't pray for them, I don't look. And when I don't look, I don't find them. Now, I don't know if you have ever prayed for an opportunity to speak to people, but why don't you start today? And put your trust in God to lead you to the very people. If you're a person who comes here on Tuesday, it would be, in my judgment, monstrous for you to pray in your prayers on Tuesday and not ask God to guide you to somebody to ask you to come to the service. I couldn't believe it. I cannot believe that you could come under this ministry week after week after week and not be begging God to guide you to the person you ought to be asking to come here. You know if you bring people here, they'll hear the gospel. Now, you must get to prayer on that. I don't mean you. I'm not suggesting you don't do it. What I'm saying is the devil will do anything to try and divert us away from this area. Now, how did I get onto that? That's a long aside, I know. But I'm taking the opportunity to say that if we've got no friends, we've got no non-Christian friends, that has got to be rectified. And quickly it's got to be rectified. It's a very, very dangerous situation. And it won't get rectified by us hoping that something will happen. We've got to take action. Well, let me tell you the other advantages we found about dialogue evangelism. First of all, we found that people who wouldn't normally go to church often came to people's homes. Secondly, we found that the relaxed atmosphere and the smallness of the group allowed people to listen more carefully to what was being said. It was delightful to be in that situation. The dialogue debate situation allowed some feedback so we could clarify ideas. Non-Christians were given the opportunity to articulate their ideas, and the host and hostesses had to put their neck right out on the block where they lived and say, "I'm Christian. Would you like to know I'm Christian? Would you like to come and talk about Christianity with us?" And they found that's where they were. Now let me talk to you about the questions which people began to ask us, because our minds will be focused on these in the days to come. The questions people generally ask, and these I've tabulated over 5 years in our part of the world and about 1,000 meetings. We gave up keeping statistics after that time because they were all much of a muchness, and we just got tired of correlating them out in our office. We had endless forms lying around the place and waiting for somebody to do something, and then we just shredded them out one day and couldn't be bothered any longer. And our questions come round about these. These are the questions people normally ask us. How do you know God exists? Now, these will come in all sorts of different forms, but they all boil down into these. I mean, a bloke might say to you one night, "There's no real proof that God is there, is there?" Or he might ask you many questions like that. You will find ways in which people have asked you, but they come round to, "Is there any real reason for believing that God is there? Are the New Testament documents reliable? Can you really trust them? What about the people who've never heard the gospel? Why does God allow evil in his world, suffering, wars, etc., etc., etc.? Do you have to go to church to be Christian? Aren't all people good? Aren't all good people Christian? Aren't all world religions the same? Isn't faith just psychological?" Now, I've listed these out because about 75% of the time you'll get these questions. And in the next 2 weeks, and at the Fair Mile weekend, we're going to address our minds to saying, what sort of answers can we give when people ask these questions? Because unless you are very different to us, I think the same sort of questions will be asked here. But I'll be able to tell you in a couple of months' time if the statistics run differently in your part of the world. And they might. They might. But in my part of the world, those are the things that are asking. Those of you who know Paul Little's book, How to Give Away Your Faith, will recognise them. They correspond exactly with the ones he has in his book. We didn't write them because they did. We just discovered it after we'd correlated ours out. He said, the 7 questions I'm most commonly asked on campus are these, and you will recognise them. His book is a very valuable book because he gives you some ready-made answers to them, and you may find them helpful. You may not. Do you want me to leave those for a little bit longer? I'll tell you as we go along anyway on those. What is the next thing I want to say? We'll come back in a moment. Now, at the dialogue meeting, what is it? It's all right, I'll come back to those later, and you won't need them because I'll be telling you the sort of ones which we'll prepare week by week. But you can come and wind the thing back here at tea time and have a little read by yourself, a private run through it. What is it that we're trying to do in these meetings? In Philippians 1:7, Paul says that the Philippian people were partakers, and the word is the word for fellowship. They fellowshipped with Paul, with him of the grace, both in his imprisonment and in the defence and confirmation of the gospel. Now, it's an interesting word, that one, that defence and confirmation of the gospel. Now, what is it I'm trying to do at a dialogue meeting? I am trying to show that what I am calling upon people to believe is believable. And I am constantly expecting people to be convinced for the reasons I've been convinced. Because if they're not convinced for the reasons I've been convinced, and I don't expect them to get convinced for the reasons I've been convinced, you know what that means about me. It means I think I'm a gullible twit. That I'm actually believing something for no good reason. And if I'm believing it for no good reason, the sooner I stop believing it, the better. One of the things that worries me in my part of the world is that people are constantly being urged to believe things for no reason at all. And it's no wonder everything fades away like a mist when the heat comes on. And there's excellent reason. The Bible never sees faith to be a leap out in the dark. That's not Bible faith. New Testament faith is believing what God has said. And if God hasn't said something, you cannot exercise faith on it. You must not exercise faith on what God hasn't said. That is sheer presumption. You make up a promise and then believe it and believe it and believe it and believe it and think it will come to pass because you've made it up. That isn't New Testament faith. And God has been very kind to us and given us excellent reasons why we ought to believe, and I'm constantly expecting people to believe that. Now, there are two elements in the way we go about giving our answers. The first are these. First of all, I think what we've got to bear in mind is this. What are the argument or arguments available, and how is the best method for me to use the arguments? Or, what will I say, and where will it lead me? Now, it seems to me this is very important, and the next 2 weeks we're going to spend our time in not only saying, what answers can I give when people ask these questions? Not only what answer can I give with how do you know God is there? But when I give the answer, where is it likely to head? And I believe that apologetics is not unlike chess. You've got to not only work out where you think...
At this point, there is a short gap of just a few seconds in the original recording.
Because I was not sitting in the other seat. And I know now that to play chess properly, you've got to be a man who sits in both directions. What am I going to do, and what is he likely to do? And I believe that in apologetics, the answer I give is as important to the next question which I ask as anything else. That the answer I give will in many ways allow the man who's on the other side to push me into one direction or another. Now, I am a great believer in the fact that we ought to move the discussion into the direction which is most likely to bring us to the gospel. And let me say that in apologetics there are four rules, in my judgment, to analyse how I'll go about giving the answer. And I commend these to you. Is the answer glorifying to God? Is it glorifying to God? That's the first thing that's important. Now, of course, in this, I'll have to be asking the question, is what I'm saying true? Is it truthful? That's the first thing. Doesn't matter how impressive it is, if it isn't truthful, it won't do any good because it won't be glorifying to God. It can't glorify God. Is it worthy of the name of God? Is it a true Christian answer? Is it a loving answer? Does it draw attention to man? Or does it draw attention to God? Now, these are the sort of things I think we ought to be asking in. Is it glorifying to God? Now, it's interesting to me, but there is a book on the market which talks about evangelism. I won't particularly name it. This man tells about a great evangelistic thing which is going on in the framework of their church. And in the back of the book, there is a long appendix in how you can get to the gospel from every question that's asked. And it tells you how to do it. And the answer to every question is the gospel. John 3:16 is the answer to every question. So whether they ask, why does God allow suffering? You're two quick jumps from that to John 3:16. And he'll show you how to do it. And he never answers any question. He just says, every question is a red herring. Every red herring gets in the way of the gospel. Only the gospel will help this man. He must hear the gospel. So it doesn't matter what the question is, he tells him. The answer to that is the gospel. So he roars straight to the gospel. Why he bothers about the three or four steps in some of them is beyond me. Now, I'm for answering questions truthfully. If you don't know the answer, say you don't know it. If there is no Christian answer, say there is no Christian answer. For that is what is glorifying to God. If we're men and women of truth, we tell the truth. If God is the God of truth and we say we're on the side of God, we ought to be telling the truth. I make no defence for what is indefensible. If they say, you know, what would you do if you went to church and you found the minister wasn't a Christian? Well, I don't make a defence for him. I say, try another church. What's that got to do with it? If he says to you, don't you get browned off at the local church? I go to my local church, there are lots of people who aren't Christians there. I say, that's right, there are lots of Christians who, there are lots of people there who aren't Christian. Would surprise me if there weren't. Lots of people who go to my doctor with nothing wrong with them too, but it doesn't stop me going when there's something wrong with me. You see, I make no defence for what is indefensible. Tell the truth. Is it a truthful answer? Is it worthy of the name of God? Is it a loving answer? Does it draw attention towards God or away from God? That's the first thing. The second question I want to ask in when I give the answer, so that's the first thing. A man asks me a question. Why does God allow suffering in his world? I'm saying whatever answer I must give now, it must be truthful. Whatever answer I give now, I must seek to glorify God in it. However I answer him, it must be a loving answer. Those are the things I'm thinking about. Second one is, does it actually meet him at the question he's asking? Now, this is hard, in my judgment. Does it answer the motivation of the question? Now, let me try and give you an illustration of what I'm saying. By the way, don't go to sleep, will you? I'm heading up towards the end of this session, and we'll stop for questions in a moment. And those of you who can hear that strange noise from below, it will soon be satisfied. When a man says to you, what about the heathen who've never heard the gospel? Do you not dimly suspect deep down in your heart that he really doesn't care about the Orca Indians up the Amazon? Secretly deep down in the back of my mind, I don't really think he is concerned about the man in the highlands of New Guinea hearing the gospel. I don't really think that's the burden of his heart. I tell you what I think he's saying. I might be wrong, but I think this is what he's saying. If God sends the bloke in the highlands of New Guinea to hell, or what's worse, if Chapman thinks God sends the man in the highlands of New Guinea to hell, who's never heard the gospel, then that is rubbish. And I dimly suspect it all is rubbish. And he is speaking nonsense. And God is unjust, if that's what happens. So we might as well dice it. Now, I may be mistaken, but I think he's reasoning some way like that. And so I try to answer him at that point. So my opening gamut to that is, well, you can be sure that whatever God does, he'll do the right thing, won't he? He never acts unjustly. Because I think that is the question he's asking. And so that's where I head out straight away. When a man says to me, there's no real proof for God's existence, is there? I always say, of course there is. Depends what you mean by proof. We'll backtrack out of that later. But I'm going for what I hear him say is his true motivation, because is he not saying if there is no real evidence, there's no reason why I ought to believe? It's unreasonable for you to ask me to believe if there's no real evidence, whereas the evidence is so good, of course he ought to believe. Now that is the second line I think I'm trying to take. The first one is it Christian, the answer? Is it glorifying to God? Second one, does it answer the motivation of the question? Now sometimes I don't know what he means. I have to ask him to tell me what he means. I might just give an answer that's fairly general around the subject. It'll be truthful. It'll be glorifying to God. I'll be aiming for it to do that. But the second thing I'm doing, and because there are many answers that can be given to most questions, we're constantly making a selection of which answer we're going to give now. So the second one is, which one answers his motivation? Third one is, does it lead me towards the gospel, or does it lead me away from the gospel? And I'm for giving the answer which is most likely to get me back to the gospel. If I can choose between one or the other, and one gets me towards the gospel and one leads me away from the gospel, I'm saying the good apologetic is the one that leads me towards the gospel. And the last one is, will it be acceptable to the believer and the hearer? Now, it's not always possible to do that. But if it is possible to do that, I'm looking for an answer. When a man says to me, do you have to believe that Jonah was swallowed by a whale to be a Christian? The answer to that is no. You don't have to believe that. But you probably will if you are. Now, you will see perfectly obviously. I said to him, you can believe that Jonah swallowed the whale if you like. But what I'm saying is, that is not germane to being Christian. You don't have to get that one sorted out before you can become a Christian. Indeed, when you are a Christian, that one is much more likely to sort itself out than to try and get it sorted out beforehand. And I believe often we're allowed to engage in terrible irrelevancies because they set the agenda. See, a lady says to me outside Parramatta Cathedral one day, "What'd you do if you went to church and found your minister wasn't a Christian?" That's irrelevant. I say, "What has that got to do with Jesus rising again from the dead? Did Jesus rise from the dead or didn't he? Try another minister, lady. You must find one sooner or later. But don't stop looking in the right place because you've had a bit of a setback there." Now, that's what I'm talking about here. Now, sometimes we've just got to simply fall back and say, "Look, God has spoken." Now, that's generally not very popular. And sometimes that's all we can do, is to fall back and to say, "God has clearly spoken a clear, precise word on this matter." That may not be very acceptable, and it may not be very believable. I'd be glad if you'd put your mind to those four things, because I'm going to ask you to prepare a few questions for next week. And the way we're going to do our training next week is that I will pretend I'm an unbeliever, and I will ask you to dialogue with me. I promise that I will not say anything that hasn't been said to me at a dialogue meeting, and so none of the answers will be harder than will be likely to be said to you. I want you to be ready to stand up. I want you to be ready to engage me in dialogue. The way that it goes on in dialogue is, you ask a question, that will be me. I will ask the question. You give an answer. Brief. Succinct. Don't say everything that's to be said. Be brief. Be very brief. I will ask the next question, and you will have to answer it. And I want you to keep going until you can't go any further. When you can't go any further, you can pass. That's the way that we're playing this game. All you need to say is pass, and you can sit down. And then somebody else who wants to pick up that line at that moment can pick it up. Right? And we will argue it right out to the end. If nobody wants to pick it up, but somebody else wants to start in a different direction, they can get the call, and we'll go through it. Now, the questions I want you to put your mind to for next week are these. I'll come back to the gospel in just a moment. I want you to be prepared to dialogue with me on the questions: how do you know God is really there? Now, I may attack that in any way it pleases me, but that is where you will need to have your information at your fingertips, and you need to have it in your head, because you cannot fumble around with a book. All right? Good. Get that ready. The second one we'll talk about is, do you have to go to church to be Christian? And one which is not unlike it, don't all good people go to heaven? We will talk about those three questions next week. That clear in your mind about that? Some of you will not want to be dialogue leaders. And if you're a person who is coming for the journey, you'll find it terrific fun, and I hope you keep coming back each week. If you don't want to be a dialogue leader, I'd be glad if you would sit towards the back. If you want to be a dialogue leader, you say, "Well, I really do want to get practice at doing it." Well, then I want you to dialogue with me, because I not only want you to hear yourself giving the answers, but I want to plot the course of where the answers are going to lead us, so that you will have some idea exactly where you're likely to end up. If I say this, which way will the discussion go then? If I say that, where will it lead me? So that you will know, you'll have worked out your moves beforehand. If you want to paddle around in Genesis and the creation and evolution, I'll tell you how you can get to it. If you want to talk about the New Testament documents and their authenticity, I'll tell you how you can get to it. And whichever way you answer a question early in the piece will determine whether you head in that direction or that direction. I don't mind paddling in either of them. I've paddled around all night in both of them. I'd rather be in one than the other, if I can make my choice. If I can't make my choice, I'll paddle where they choose to paddle. But I want you to be ready, and I want you to hear yourself articulating it. And I want you to be ready quickly to speak next week. It will be a terrible bog and a waste of time if I'm saying, "Well, who will do it? Please, who will do it? Please, please." because you cannot learn without doing it. Now, will you put your mind to that? You might like to put yourself to prayer during the week too, so that if you're a person who's got the gifts and can do this, that God will make that known to you, and that if you're a person who doesn't have the gifts, that he will make that known to you too. And that people who might have the gifts and are shy will be able to tell the difference. All right? You might like to pray that for yourself and for other people here. But I particularly want a dialogue next week with people who think they might like to do it. Have I made myself clear at that point? Can you understand what I'm talking about or not? How's the people who cannot understand? You can understand? Great, that's terrific. Is there anyone who cannot understand what I'm talking about? Hands to the people who are frightened to say if they can't. All right. Now, I think at this stage we must briefly talk about the gospel. Not because I think it's brief or unimportant. Let me see if I've said anything. Yes, I have just about. We can turn this off now and give it a rest. It's warm where you are. It's lovely and warm here. Has anybody got a piece of toast? It's just ready for toasting at the present moment, just this machine. Those of you who weren't here last week might quickly like to put your hands straight up in the air, like a flag on Empire Day, and Steve, you might start those on the move, will you? And you might like to start those on the move over there. Please do not take it if you were here last week. Oh, I didn't mean you to give them out, Steve. Just pass them around in a bulk. People will do that. Now, I take it those of you who were here last week have got an outline of the gospel, haven't you? Is that right? Yeah, good. Now, I want to quickly go over that for those of you who weren't here last week. And then I want to leave time for questions. Straight up in the air, if you haven't got a dialogue of evangelism, if you're getting the new booklet, it will be good for you to head off... Oh, that's a great help. To page nine. Page nine of the booklet. Straight up. Look, I'm sorry about that. My father said to me when I came home after having taught for the first term, he said to me, "Do not speak to me like that again. You're not at school now." And I realised that I was beginning to speak to the whole of mankind as if I was addressing a classroom. Where are those? Any of them left over? Have they come to an end? They've come to a bitter end. Well, those of you who don't have one will have to look on with somebody. And what will we do about them? My goodness. Is there anybody who took an extra one? Own up now. This is time for confession. Oh, good. Thank you. That would be helpful. Thank you, John. Very much indeed. Is that a spare one? Will you pass it over backwards? It's a leftover one, is it? Oh, you're sharing. Is there anybody else who could share just for tonight? Can you? Where is it? Oh, it doesn't matter. Can you look on over there? Now, where are we now? Who hasn't got one? All right, well, we'll have to see if we can do something for you. You might have to borrow one from a friend and get a photostat copy. Can you do that? I'm sorry about that, but I brought as many from Australia that I could probably think that we'd need, and I've run out. On page 9, will you go to the outline of the gospel? We use this outline of the gospel because we've tried to do away with technical language. And I want you... If you do not like my outline of the gospel and you don't wish to use it, well then, and you'd like to write out an alternative one, do it next week and let me see it. And I'll tell you where I think its strengths and weaknesses are. But if you like my outline, I'd like you also to be ready next week to be able to get up and say it. If you're going to use my outline and you're going to do dialogue evangelism, well then, I want you to be able to get up next week as well as be able to address yourself to the three questions and to do the gospel outlines. And during supper time next week, we'll be practicing it with each other. And there's no way of knowing if you can do it than if you can get up and do it. If you can't get up and do it, you can't do it. And so I'm asking you to have this ready. All right, these are my outlines to it. I've tried to do away with the technical language, as I explained last week, because I do not think people understand the technical language. And I've divided my outline into 5 points. The first one is this. This is God's world and he made it. And we belong to God. We are not our own to do as we like. God has made Jesus Christ master in his world and he's assured us of this by raising him to life from the dead. Jesus has the right to control our lives completely. The second point is that all men are rebellious to the idea that Jesus Christ ought to control their lives. They want to be independent. Their rebellion may be in open hostility, or it may be in passive indifference. But whether it's in open hostility or passive indifference, it's real nonetheless. Thirdly, God does the only thing you'd expect him to do. He calls on men and women to stop rebelling against the right of Jesus Christ to rule their lives. Two more things. What happens if a man stops rebelling, and what happens if he doesn't? If a person turns back and stops rebelling, I've dropped out amnesty, as I said last week, God treats him as if he'd never been a rebel. He forgives him. Not because his sins are small, but because Jesus Christ has died on his behalf. When I go through this outline, I normally say something at this stage like, you may like to ask a question about this later, I'm not going to elaborate on it now. I do it purposely because I can't think of anything finer than to ask a question about the death of Jesus, can you? And I do it purposely for that. If anyone's going to ask a question about the outline, I'm hoping they're going to ask it at that point. And so I always say it there. That is, I'm aiming to fight from the ground which is the best possible conceivable ground to fight from. I cannot vouch for the authenticity of this, but I understand that somebody said at Waterloo to Wellington, this is a magnificent position that you are in. Are you not lucky to have got in this position to fight from here? To which he said, lucky? He said, I've been looking for somebody to fight me here for years. I saw it years ago. Now, I cannot vouch for that, whether it's true or not. It's like that with the gospel. I am always aiming to fight from where I am at my strength. If I have got any opportunity to set the tune, that is where I set it, where we'll fight from our position of strength. And I'm hoping they'll ask a question there, so I always invite a question to it. So you may wish to ask a question later. I do hope you will. I always beam over the gathering at that stage, as it's very good form to ask a question about the death of Jesus. Finally, what happens if a man goes on indefinitely and will not repent? Why, in the end, he must be overthrown, not basically because God is temperamental and loses his temper, but because Jesus really is Lord. And depending on whether I'm in very high-class company or whether I'm in the rough and tough of the western suburbs of Sydney, I generally say at the end of it, I wonder if you'd like to ask a question or make a contribution? Or, well, how does that grab you? Depending on where we are. And I generally then, it's over to discussion. I haven't said a great deal about the gospel because I went through it at great length last week. Those of you who were not here last week will see as we quickly run through it that in the first point we are speaking about the sovereignty of God and the lordship of Christ. In the second point we're talking about the universal nature of sin. In the third one we're talking about repentance. In the fourth one we're talking about justification and forgiveness. And in the last one we're talking about judgment. And I want to submit to you that that isn't a bad outline. I am concerned when people begin with man and his need. It's possible to preach the gospel properly if you begin with man and his need. You just generally don't. It's not impossible to start with man and his need and preach the gospel. It's just very hard. If you start with God and his world, you can hardly ever muck it up. It's not always interesting to me to see that is where the Bible writers begin. The gospel is a message about God. It is not fundamentally a message about you. It's a message about Jesus. In Romans 1, Paul says he is set apart for God's gospel, the gospel concerning his Son. That's what the gospel is about. It's not basically about you and your need. That's quite secondary. The gospel is about Jesus and his lordship. It's only incidental that you happen to turn out to be a terrible rebel and need to be forgiven. The gospel is about Jesus being Lord over his great enemy, Satan. Well, I won't go into that. Now, do you want to ask a question about anything before we proceed to have supper? Yes, please ask many questions.
Supposing your dialogue discussion next week, you talk about life after death or the second coming. I am one of those who believes that Christ will physically come back on this earth. Share equally so that those who share that second coming with a family or something similar. if we're going to pass or go on, it could be, depending on the divergence of that view, as to who takes it up and why and where.
Well, what is the question you're actually asking me, please?
I believe that Christ will physically come again to the earth.
Yes.
There are many people who don't believe.
That's right.
Right. There are many people who say they are supposed to be divine Christians who do not believe.
Yes.
Next week, we may have someone who takes you along the path, which is different to that view, which I go fast.
Mm-hmm.
How can I, if I just pass on to me, support something which I believe to be erroneous, inherent?
Are you asking me what I believe about the second coming personally? Or, well, I'm saying that you, I take it I wouldn't invite somebody to lead a dialogue meeting in my home that I didn't have any confidence in. I wouldn't invite him. Is that, have I understood your question correctly? I'm sorry about that. Will you try with me again, please?
Granted, it's a deep theological question. It's a question in our
church. Yes, I understand the question.
But if you are the unbeliever,
yeah,
and one a person is doing the answer,
yes,
albeit satisfactory to a certain point in time, I mean, when I would think that the crushing blow would be that Christ would once again come to this earth and physically come to this earth.
Yep.
He's not saved, but he's taken away, and then subsequently he is defeated by you.
Oh, you can go back to square one if you like. You mean in our training session here? Oh, I thought you meant about a dialogue meeting. Oh, I'm sorry about that. Oh, you can go back to square one. You can say, no, I don't want to pick up that point at that point. I'd like to go back to square one again. Those, yes, it's like Monopoly. Yes. You don't have to go to jail all the time. You can go right back to Tours and start all over again. Was that okay, pal? Good work. Thank you for asking me, and thank you for persisting with me until I found out what you were asking. I'm sorry about that.
You said that when people ask questions, one of the points to consider is, does it answer the motivation of the question?
Yes.
If we try to think, what is the motivation of this question?
Yeah.
Are we not in danger of saying, this is the motivation, when in fact it isn't?
Yep. Yes, a very good question. Did you hear the question over there? Yes? Yes or no? Yes? Please tell me your name. This lady over here, thank you so much for telling me. This lady over here says, when I say, do you actually have to try and find out what the motivation of the questioner is, am I not running the danger of making an error in judgment about what the motivation is? And the answer is, yes, indeed I am. And that's why I've got to take the greatest amount of care. And that is why I must give an answer which is a genuine answer to the question. That is, it's no good me saying, I know what this bloke's saying. So let me go back to here. Is it glorifying to God? It must be truthful. See, it must be truthful. Whatever I say has got to be right. But I try and make a selection of all the right things I can say, which heads out in a direction. Now I might give an answer and discover, as we go on in the discussion, that what I thought was his motivation was not his motivation at all. Let me say that on the question of suffering, you must take the greatest amount of care, because people never disclose their terrible questions because it's too painful. They always ask them in what appear to me to be couched in very academic way. And so on the one about suffering, they generally say something like, do you think God's got control of everything in the world? See, it sounds very innocent, doesn't it? Well, one night I said, yes, I think everything. And she pursued it. She said, every single thing. I said, yes, I believe every single thing. And I was beginning to get less confident and more gentle and more quiet. She said, my son was killed last week in the Voyager disaster. Do you think God had that under control? Now, Brian Telfer told me that he was at a meeting one night, and a man asked a question about why God allowed tragedies to take place. And that as the night went on, it became revealed that he had actually backed over his son going down the drive one day. Now, whatever you do at that moment, you cannot afford to be glib. Now, I find that that question never comes out in that form to start with. It always sounds like a very, very academic question. And I take it that people cannot ask it in any other way. It's too painful. Now, I'm saying all the time, whatever answer I give, it's got to be truthful. And I must always reckon on point two here that in the final and ultimate analysis, I cannot be sure unless they tell me. But I'm making a judgment, and I'm saying that that's one of the things I bear in mind. But I can never be sure unless he says. This is the reason I'm asking, and he's unlikely to tell me that, isn't he? But as time goes by, I've learned that they begin to reveal what the question was. And sometimes I don't. But there is a possibility of keeping to check out what the question is. I generally keep saying, have I really understood your question? See, it's often you give the answer and it's perfectly obvious you haven't understood it. He knew I hadn't understood it. In fact, I thought I hadn't understood it too. That's why I asked again and again and yet again. Very kind thing for that brother to keep trying with me three times, being adult. But we found out in the end there's a way to do it. And I think that this is the way to do it. When you haven't understood, I say, look, have I really understood you? Come clean. Sometimes people say yes when they mean no because they can't be bothered. Your point is a point well taken, and thank you for saying it. Yeah, are you happy about that? Yeah, good. Well, it's time we stop for supper. During supper, I take it you'll get my ear and talk to me about anything which is not clear. I'll be buzzing around. One or two things about supper. Please don't move yet. Because I'd like to get a check on who is here and who isn't here, and especially if you're going to be a dialogue leader, I'm getting the role marked. And that's another teaching thing. So if you are A to Moan. Yes, A to Moan. Where do they go? They go to that table over there. So if your surname starts with A to M-A-U-G-H-A-N, go there. If, on the other hand, you start McLaughlin to W, go there. Hands up the people who are A's to M-A-U-G-H-A-N. Hands up those people. Hands down. Hands up those who are McLaughlin to W. Hands up those who don't know. Incredible. When you go over there, will you pay for your food when you go? Will you see that your name is ticked on the list? So we'll know who's there. And the other thing is, if you have not registered for any reason, or if you're not having supper here, you might like to go and get your names ticked on that table. And if your name is not on a list because you snuck in unaware, if you just came because you were glad you're here, will you see that your name goes on the list? I don't think there's anything more to say. We will begin promptly at 8:15.